the form of raw, unbridled rage. Rage against the people who had killed Jonas, her friend, her colleague, and someone who might have been much more. Rage against the people who had started the outbreak in Kenya that had killed Lucas Turner and thousands of others. She would find these people. She would stop them. And she would make them pay, even if it was the last thing she did. Chapter 42. Millen Thomas heard the camp come alive outside his tent. Boots pounded the hard-packed Kenyan ground. Doors slammed. Body bags were tossed onto the bed of a truck. He rose from his cot, threw the tent flap back, and walked out. The Kenyan army detail that had rescued him from the cave was scouring the village for their belongings, and for their fallen comrades who had died during the night raid on the camp. Millen had known they would leave, but he hadn't expected it to be so soon. Last night, the CDC and WHO had evacuated all their personnel from Kenya. A flight with the field teams had left from Mandera. Another from Nairobi evacuated the support personnel. Millen had been ordered to be on the flight that left Mandera, but he had refused. Evacuating meant leaving Hannah and Dr. Shaw behind. He had decided to disobey orders, to stay, wait, and hope there was something he could do here. And now, when the troops left, he'd be alone in the village. Keito approached him. "We're pulling out, Dr. Thomas. Orders."
"Where?"
"Nairobi. The government has declared a nationwide state of emergency. Martial law. They're setting up containment camps in every major city." Millen nodded.
"Come with us,"
Keito said.
"No. I need to wait for my people. If they're rescued, they won't return here."
Millen had been thinking the same thing.
"Where will they take them?"
he asked.
"I'm not sure."
"What's common in kidnap and ransom after the rescue?" Keito considered the question a moment.
"Depends on the rescuers. If they're operating from a ship, they'll be taken back there, somewhere in the Indian Ocean, or perhaps to the closest airport, Mandera likely."
Mandera. It was his best shot. Keito read his reaction.
"A word of advice, doctor."
"What's that?"
"Set out at daybreak. It will be safer."
"Yeah, that's a good idea.
We'll leave you a four-wheel drive, water and rations."
Keito paused.
"And a gun."
"I won't need it. We'll leave it just in case. You have a solar charger for your phone?"
Millen nodded.
"Very good. Best of luck to you, Dr. Thomas."
"You too, Keito."
As the Kenyan was walking away, Millen yelled to him,
"Keito!"
When he turned, Millen said,
"Thanks again for getting me out of that cave. It was the least I could do. You came here to help us. We won't forget it."
When the cloud of red dust settled from the convoy's departure, Millen returned to his tent, ripped open an MRE, and ate in silence, surveying Hannah's neatly ordered site of their shared domicile. He had met her 6 months ago during EIS orientation. At first, he had thought she was neurotic and uptight, but as he'd gotten to know her, he realized the truth. She cared. Being prepared and doing a good job were important to her. She had a kind heart, and it had led her to medicine. She cared about patients like he cared about animals. He had suggested they bunk together in camp during the deployment to compare notes from the medical and veterinary side of the investigation. "Who knows?" he had added. "In our off hours, we could find the breakthrough to stop the pandemic." But he had been hoping for a different kind of breakthrough. When the food was gone, he drew out his phone. The Audible app appeared with the Nightingale's book cover, ready to resume the story where he and Hannah had left off. He needed a distraction, something to take his mind off the waiting and worrying. He wanted to press play, to listen to the story as he drifted off to sleep. But he decided what he wanted even more was to finish it with Hannah, when she returned, safe and unharmed. He set the phone down and closed his eyes. Dr. Shaw was right. Thinking was the enemy of sleep. Chapter 43. Elim Kibbit drifted in and out of consciousness. Day turned into night and back again, like a light being flipped on and off. The fever flowed like the tide, surging, overwhelming him, roasting his body from the inside, then withdrawing, leaving him to think it would never return. His symptoms grew worse each day. He found it harder to think. His hope of recovery faded. Dread took its place. Only when he had lost that last bit of hope did he realize how much he had truly held on to. The bonfire outside his window grew larger each night. At first they tossed only the suits and contaminated material onto the blaze. Then came the bodies. And then the night arrived when no fire was lit, and Alim knew that he was not the only one in danger. The entire place was in trouble. He waited for the news he knew would come soon. The door opened, and Nia Okeke entered once again. The official with the Kenyan Ministry of Health had given him Z-Map and insisted he take the room the American had stayed in. Now she wheeled in a cart piled high with bottles of ORS, clean buckets for bodily fluids, and boxes of antibiotics and painkillers. She parked the cart within his reach and sat on the bed just beside his chest.
"We're leaving, Ilim."
"You can't."
"We must."
He looked down, his fever-ridden mind searching for an argument to keep them here for the sake of his patients. She seemed to read his mind.
"There's nothing you can say. There simply aren't enough patients left here."
"How many?"
"Two, including you. The other young man will likely pass before we leave."
Elim exhaled and nodded.
"Where will you go?"
"Dadaab, then Nairobi. We're setting up camps with military and health workers."
In his mind, Elim could already see what would happen if they couldn't contain the outbreak. The government would fail. Warlords would emerge. A new civil war would start, sparking an endless fight over land and resources. Bandits would rule the roads. This plague would set Kenya back 100 years. And it had started here in Mandera, in this very room.
"Before you came," he said in labored breaths, "I was wondering how long I'd be able to keep this place open. I never imagined it would end this way, that I'd be the last patient to die here, that it would die with me. Have faith, Elim. It's the best medicine, and you'll need it even more if the medicine doesn't work."
Chapter 44. In his study in Atlanta, Elliot Shapiro was growing increasingly frustrated.
"This is no time for politics. These are people's lives we're talking about here. Have you found them? Tell me, please."
He listened, then interrupted.
"I don't care what your orders are. Listen to me. Hello? Hello?"
He set the phone down and rubbed his eyebrows. With each passing hour, he knew the possibility of recovering Peyton and her team was slipping away. It was like watching a family member die in slow motion. It was torture. He hadn't slept a wink last night. Neither had Rose. He had sat in the den, scanning news channels and websites, waiting for any news while he listened to Rose sneezing and coughing. He had brought her water and food from the kitchen periodically, sat by the bed, and asked her how her book was. Her symptoms had stabilized, but he was still terrified that the virus she and so many others had contracted was in fact the same virus that had already killed thousands in Kenya. They had created a sort of makeshift quarantine in the house. Elliot's son, daughter-in-law, and grandson had kept to the second floor, while Elliot and Rose occupied the first floor. His grandson was running around in the bonus room over the garage, having a great time, while his parents played with him. Each group was heating frozen food from the freezer and eating separately. It wasn't the ideal Thanksgiving, but it would keep the contagion from spreading. In the family room, Elliot turned on the TV.
"Despite growing concerns about the flu-like virus spreading across the U.S., many families chose not to alter their Thanksgiving plans this year."
The video shifted to a middle-aged man standing in front of a brick colonial home.
"We figured everybody was sick, so may as well be together. Tradition's important to us."
Elliot flipped the channel, scanning for more news.
"The infection rate is now estimated at 20 million in the U.S. alone. The virus, which authorities are calling X1, is intermittent in nature and causes symptoms similar to seasonal flu. Those infected report feeling under the weather for a few days, then well for a day or two before the symptoms return. Officials at the CDC and NIH have urged individuals to exercise vigilance throughout the flu season, including washing your hands and..."
Elliot changed the channel again. AAA reports that despite an uptick in flu activity, they expect a record number of travelers to take to the roads this Thanksgiving weekend. Air travel is also projected to set a new high. Retailers are banking on strong Black Friday sales, with Wall Street analysts calling for a 10% growth in sales over last year.
It was a perfect biological storm. A highly contagious virus, amplifying at the precise moment when movement around the country was at its highest.
Elliot walked back into his office, closed the doors, and dialed a number at the CDC. To his surprise, voicemail picked up.
Jacob, it's Elliot. Call me, thanks.
He dialed the man's cell and was relieved when he answered.
Jacob, please tell me you've sequenced this respiratory virus and compared it with the Mendera samples.
Elliot sat up at Jacob's response.
What? I know it's Thanksgiving.
He paused to listen.
Listen to me, Jacob. This is going to be the last Thanksgiving if those viruses are the same. No, Jacob, Monday is too late. You've got to go back in. Finish it. Call your team. What? Jacob!
Elliot felt like screaming. He called the EOC once again, hoping to get a different operator. The response was the same. The head of watch had instructed every operator not to give Elliot any status updates. He was officially locked out, at perhaps the most critical time in the agency's history. Day 6. 300 million infected. 70,000 dead. Chapter 45. At first, Millen thought it was the wind blowing through the camp, whipping against the empty tents, the flapping and howling only sounding like voices. As his sleepiness faded, he realized the sounds actually were voices. Several people, arguing in hushed tones just outside his tent. He rolled over, careful not to make any noise. The morning sun cast three figures in shadow against the tent's white fabric, like shadow puppets creeping toward him. They paused, pointed, and continued past him, talking quickly. Millen heard them enter the main tent, crates being opened, ransacked. He rose and pulled on his shoes. The SUV Quito had left him stood at the edge of the camp nearby. The main tent was on the opposite side of the camp, away from him, and Millen could see the shadows of three figures moving inside. They were turning the place upside down, looking for something. They obviously thought they were alone now. They spoke more loudly, in a language Millen didn't recognize. Millen wanted to break for the SUV and get away. But what if they knew something? What if they had taken Hannah and Dr. Shaw? He pulled on his flak jacket with the CDC logo and grabbed the rifle Quito had left him. It was semi-automatic with a banana-shaped magazine. Millen had fired exactly one gun in his life. A .22 caliber rifle during his stint in the Boy Scouts. The gun in his hand was a lot meaner looking, and deadlier. He gripped the weapon, ensured the safety was off, and crept toward the main tent. The flaps were down, obscuring his approach. His fear gripped tighter around him with every step. His mouth watered. He swallowed, gathering up his courage. His heart was beating out of his chest. If he didn't charge or run at that moment, he figured he'd have a heart attack. With the gun held out, he ducked and burst through the tent flaps. Three figures sat around the long table, gorging themselves. Opened MRE cartons lay strewn across the floor and table. Millen recognized them. The three Kenyan villagers they had found hiding when the team had arrived here. The villagers stared at him, eyes wide with fear, then jumped up and stumbled over the folding chairs, falling as they scrambled to escape. Millen quickly set the gun on the ground and held his hands up.
Wait, stop, I'm CDC!
He pointed to the white letters on his jacket.
I was here before. American, help!
He spread his arms, blocking the entrance. A girl, maybe 13 years old, stopped.
Yes, I'm an American, Millen said again. Here to help!
Millen finally got the three villagers settled down. After a few minutes, he convinced them to resume their meal. The teenage girl, Halima, was the only one who spoke English. As they ate, she recounted the raid on the village. Hearing it firsthand was hard for Millen. When the shooting began, the three villagers had hidden under their cots in the isolation tent. They fled after Peyton told them to, From the bushes at the village's outskirts, they watched the raid unfold.
Deran, the dark-haired woman with smooth white skin, a man, and a girl with red hair. They shot her.
Who?
The red-haired woman.
Millen leaned back in the chair, unable to speak.
I'm sorry, Halima said quietly.
Millen stared at the white canvas swaying in the morning breeze.
What happened after that?
His voice was hollow.
The dark-haired woman picked her up. They ran to a truck and drove away. There was an explosion. The truck crashed. More shooting. I couldn't see what happened. I'm sorry.
Millen nodded.
Thank you for telling me.
When they were done eating, he asked them where they would go. The teenager simply shrugged.
I'm going to Mandera, Millen said. You three are welcome to come with me.
She hesitated.
I'm sure the Kenyan government will be setting up survivor camps soon. There will be food, water, probably work to do. Be a lot better than staying here.
The teenager conversed with her two companions. Finally, she turned to Millen.
Yes, we'll come with you.
During a deployment, standard operating procedure was to notify ops when changing a fixed position. But since the ops group had evacuated Nairobi, Millen called the EOC in Atlanta.
You didn't evacuate?
The operator asked.
No, I'm still here. Hold the line.
Millen could hear shouting in the background. It sounded like 100 voices talking at once, like the floor of the New York Stock Exchange had been transplanted to the CDC. He caught snippets.
50,000 cases in Kansas. Navy has confirmed cases on 3 aircraft carriers.
The operator came back on the line.
Stay where you are, Dr. Thomas. We've got a situation here. Someone will contact you. I can't stay here.
Millen said, but the line was dead. The call left Millen wondering what was going on in Atlanta and the rest of America. 50,000 cases in Kansas? Had the virus they'd found in Kenya reached the U.S.? He desperately wanted to know what was happening and to let someone know where he was going. There was really only one more number he could call. Chapter 46. Elliot didn't remember falling asleep in the chair, but he awoke in the middle of the night with a blanket drawn over him, the remote in his lap, the TV on. He coughed several times, brought his hand to his neck and felt his lymph nodes. They were swollen. Sweat covered his forehead. The fever was low grade, but there was no mistake. He was infected. On the TV, a reporter on a financial news network was speaking against a chart with a red trend line dropping sharply as it moved right. Asian stock markets shed more than 40% of their value today following news that Singapore would close its borders and declare martial law, and claims that China would soon begin closing its ports to prevent further spread of the X1 virus. The WHO has stopped releasing infection estimates, sparking fears that infection rates may be far higher than has been reported. That fear seems to be spilling over into the markets. In America, the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ will close at 1 p.m. in observance of Black Friday, and losses are expected to be steep. Futures are trading off 20%. Elliot's phone rang, and he stared at the number, still groggy. He didn't recognize it.
Shapiro.
Sir, it's Millen Thomas. I called you day before yesterday. I was working with Dr. Shaw's team.
Elliot sat up.
I remember, Millen. What can I do for you?
The EOC in Atlanta is apparently overwhelmed. I'm here at our camp at the village where the raid occurred.
Elliot was shocked. All the CDC personnel in Kenya had been evacuated after the raid.
You're still in Kenya?
Yes, sir. I decided to stay. I thought maybe I could help somehow.
Elliot nodded.
Okay, what's happening there?
The Kenyan military escort left yesterday. I'm thinking of going to Mandera. But I can't get any guidance on whether that's the right move.
It's a better spot than the village, but it's hard for me to advise you. I don't know who's in Mandera or the status of any operations in Kenya. I'm sorry, Millen, I'm out of the loop here.
Understood, sir. Well, I feel better knowing at least someone knows my location. I've got 3 survivors here. We found them in the village when we first arrived. I'm going to take them and head up to Mandera.
Survivors? Elliot felt a glimmer of hope. If they had survived the disease, then analyzing their antibodies, which had defeated the virus, could be the key to finding a treatment.
Listen to me, Millen.
We've got to get those survivors back to the CDC for analysis.
How?
I'll arrange transport. Just get to Mandara and stay safe. I'll call you back. Keep your phone charged.
It took Elliot 3 calls before he reached someone who could transport Millen and the survivors back to Atlanta. It would be more than 3 days before they arrived in America, but better late than never. Elliot napped in the family room until the morning sun blazed through the French doors. The house was still quiet, and he took the opportunity to do some work he dreaded, work he knew had to be done. In his study, he turned on his computer and made a list of everyone he needed to warn. Then he made a list of his neighbors. He and Rose lived in an established, older neighborhood just outside Atlanta, close to the CDC. The homes weren't mansions, but they were authentic, well-built, and expensive. Doctors, lawyers, and business owners shared the street with them. Elliot wrote down the names of the neighbors he thought he could rely on, the ones he thought would have steady hands in a crisis. And a crisis was coming. He was certain of that. At 7 a.m., he brought Rose, Ryan, and Sam into his office and told them his plan. By the time he was done, Rose was crying quietly. Ryan and Sam nodded solemnly and told Elliot he had their full support. Next, he began making calls to the people he wanted to warn. By 10 o'clock, 5 husbands and wives sat in his living room.
"I'm sorry to take you away from your families," Elliot said, "but I believe your families and mine will soon be in very real danger."
Surprised, confused expressions stared back at him.
"What are you—" Elliot held up a hand. "Just give me a minute, Bill. It'll all make sense."
In 2004, Congress passed the Project BioShield Act. On the surface, it was a bill that called for $5 billion to spend on stockpiling vaccines and other countermeasures against bioterror and pandemics. But what the public doesn't know is that there are secret provisions in the act, provisions that are only invoked in the event of a catastrophic biological event. I believe we are witnessing the beginning of such an event. I believe this respiratory virus, X1, may actually be the early stages of the Ebola-like hemorrhagic fever that is currently devastating Kenya. If they are one and the same virus, I believe that Project BioShield will soon be invoked to try to stop that outbreak. When that occurs, the America we know and love will change very drastically. What I'm about to tell you must never leave this room.
When Elliot was done speaking, one of the men leaned forward and said,
"Let's say you're right. What do we do?"
"That's why you're here. I have a plan, and I need your help."
Chapter 47. In the metal and glass cell, Desmond lay on the narrow bed, watching the never-ending slideshow. A few of the photos were from his childhood, but the bulk of them depicted him at industry trade shows or at business meetings. They began in his early 20s and ran nearly up until the present. Either his captors didn't have pictures of his personal life, or none existed. The people who came and went outside his cell asked him a range of questions, careful to never reveal anything about their cause and goals, but here and there he gathered small clues, which he catalogued, hoping they would help him escape. After they left, Desmond felt his stomach growl. They had fed him very little, perhaps hoping to keep him weak and docile. Instead, the sensation brought back another memory. For the first year that Desmond lived in Oklahoma, his uncle left him at a preschool when he was working on the rigs. The kids there were of varying ages, but at 6 years old, Desmond was among the oldest. Several of the other oil workers left their children there, too, and he made a few friends. But every time Orville returned to pick him up, he argued with the owners about the price, complaining that it was highway robbery. One day, Orville announced that he was leaving Desmond at home. He put some money on the counter and told Desmond that if he had to come home to tend to him, he'd make him sorry. Desmond used the money to buy food at the small grocery store in town. The owner helped him count out the money and stretch it as best he could. His diet consisted of beans and canned meat. Still, he ran out of money a few days before his uncle returned. At the grocery store, he didn't ask for credit. He asked where he could find a job.
"For a 6-year-old?"
The skinny man with small glasses laughed. Desmond looked at his shoes.
"I'll give you some things on credit, Desmond. You can settle up when your uncle gets back." I'd rather not, he said quietly. Thankfully, the grocer told him to sweep out the supply room and stock some of the shelves, and sent him home with enough food to get him through a few more days. When his uncle returned, the first thing he said was,
How much have you got left?
Nothing.
Nothing? You spent it all? On what, boy? A new Barbie doll?
He stormed off, muttering that Desmond would eat him out of house and home. The man was obsessed with money. He would work on whatever rig paid him the most. He didn't care how dangerous it was or how bad the camp conditions were. He wanted the money, and he kept it all to himself. He deeply distrusted banks.
They're all crooks,
he said, one night when he was into the second half of the bottle.
Fools, too. They'll loan any Tom, Dick, or Harry money. Your money, that is, the same dollars you put in the vault. The thrifts are the worst. They'll be busted soon, you watch.
Desmond was actually quite surprised when a few years later, over 1,000 savings and loans, thrifts, as they were known, collapsed, costing American taxpayers over $130 billion to bail them out. It was perhaps the only one of his uncle's predictions and conspiracy theories that came true. His uncle continued to leave him home alone after that first time, and Desmond soon figured out how to make the money last. He supplemented it with meat from animals he killed. Some he took out of season, but he figured the game warden probably wouldn't find a 6-year-old boy slowly starving to death. He made sure to have a few dollars left over, waiting on the counter when his uncle returned, and sometimes he managed to have a bit more, which he saved for himself. When he'd saved enough, he visited the pawn shop at the edge of town. He had stood outside this shop at least 2 dozen times, gazing through the window at the bike, imagining himself riding it, all the places he would go. Now he went inside, laid his money on the glass-top display case and said, I'll take the bike in the window. The proprietor picked up the bills, counted them out, and said,
You're short $10.
That's all I've got.
The man said nothing.
Desmond reached for the bills. Take it or leave it. I'm going to the hardware store next to make them an offer.
The man let out a ragged smoker's cough.
If you were a grown man, I'd tell you to piss off.
But I like you, kid. Take it. Damn thing's been in the window a year now anyway.
It was Desmond's first taste of freedom. The first thing he had ever saved up for and bought on his own. He treasured it more than any gift he'd ever been given. He also hid it from his uncle. That lasted 6 months. It was the best period of his entire childhood. With the bike's added range, he was able to visit the next town over, Noble, which had shops along the main street, a post office, a small cinema, and a library. Inside the library, he wandered the stacks, searching for the books Charlotte had read to him. He just wanted to see the covers again to remind him of those weeks they'd spent together. A woman with gray hair was taking books from a cart and placing them back on the shelves.
Can I help you find something?
Desmond shook his head.
You can check out anything you like, she said.
She studied him for a long second.
It's free. You bring them back whenever you're done.
It wouldn't do him any good. He still couldn't read.
Is there a time when someone reads?
The woman hesitated.
Yes, there is.
When?
There's several times. When would be convenient?
He told her, and she said that would be fine. Her name was Agnes. Desmond liked her voice. It was soothing and neutral, like other people in Oklahoma. It didn't carry the meanness his uncle's did. As he was leaving, Desmond realized he hadn't asked about the book. It could be one he hated, or one about people falling in love, for all he knew. Trying not to sound rude, he asked Agnes what book would be read.
There's several to choose from, she said. What sort of books do you like?
Adventure books,
he answered without hesitation.
Where the hero gets away.
Then you won't be disappointed.
And he wasn't. The next day he returned to find Agnes knitting behind the counter. She set down her work and held up a book.
Are you ready?
He nodded. As he had suspected, he was the only one at the storytelling session. That was fine by him. He lost himself as the words she spoke became pictures in his mind.
then characters that were as real as anyone he had ever met. The stories felt like another life he had only forgotten, a life much better than the one he was living. Storytime was his escape. The weeks when his uncle was home were a prison sentence. Summer ended, and a letter arrived from the county school district, assigning him to an elementary school where he'd start kindergarten in the fall. Orville tossed it in the fire with disgust.
"Kindergarten," he said the word as if it tasted like sour milk. "You don't need to get any softer than you already are."
That was fine by Desmond. He far preferred the library. After Thanksgiving, Agnes began teaching him to read. He picked it up quickly. She used a good strategy. She read the first part of the book, enough to get him enthralled, then helped him read the rest. It was like learning to ride the bike, hard at first, but a breeze once you got the hang of it. By Easter, he was reading to her. And she was changing little by little. She fell asleep during the stories. With growing frequency, she reached into her purse, took out a pill, and swallowed it. One day that summer, he arrived to find the library closed. It stayed closed every day for a week. Desmond walked into the post office next door and asked the man behind the counter if he'd seen Agnes. "She's at Norman."
"Who's Norman?"
The postman looked at Desmond like he was an idiot. "The hospital. Norman Municipal. Well, regional now, as if it matters."
"What's she doing there?"
"She's there with the cancer. Why else?"
Desmond stood there, his world collapsing.
"Is she coming back?"
He could tell by the look on the man's face that she wasn't.
"How do I get there?"
"You better speak to your parents about that."
"What roads do I take?"
"Norman's 10 miles away, young man. Your parents can take you. Now get on. I've got work to do."
At the gas station on the edge of town, Desmond bought a map. The hospital was marked with a large H. The next morning, he plotted his course and packed food in a bag. Desmond never knew exactly what day Orville would be back from the rigs, but he usually arrived home by early afternoon. So Desmond waited until 4 p.m. before setting out, just to be sure he wasn't coming. He couldn't imagine what the man would do if he caught him riding home on a bike he had bought with Orville's money. He figured the trip would take less than an hour, but he was wrong. It took him nearly 3. The sun was setting when he reached the Norman city limits. The parking lot lights glowed in the clear night as he rode up, dropped his bike by the front door, and staggered in. The woman at the reception desk gave Desmond Agnes's room number. For the first time in his life, he rode an elevator. On the 4th floor, he walked slowly toward Agnes's room, afraid of what he'd see. The door was closed. He pushed the handle, let the thick wooden door creak open. The lights were dim inside. Agnes lay on her side, machines beeping softly around her. She turned at the sound of the door, saw Desmond. A smile crossed her lips, and tears filled her eyes.
"You shouldn't be here, Desmond."
He couldn't think of anything to say. He just walked into the room, up to her bed, and held out his small hand, which she took.
"Why didn't you?"
He didn't complete the sentence, because he had no idea what he intended to ask. He hadn't thought this part out. In his mind, he had never accepted what the postman had said. He'd expected to arrive and learn that it had all been a mistake. She exhaled.
"I was going to tell you I was moving away. I didn't want you to know I was sick. Didn't want this to be your last memory of me."
Desmond studied his feet.
"Did your uncle bring you?"
she asked. He shook his head.
"Surely you didn't ride your bike."
She apparently took his silence for confirmation.
"Desmond," she said slowly, "that was very dangerous. Where's your uncle?"
"On the rigs. Won't be back for a few days."
A nurse appeared in the open doorway.
"Do you need anything, Miss Andrews?"
"Yes, dear. Some blankets for my nephew. He'll be spending the night. And this may be a tall order, but I wonder if there are any children's books in the hospital?"
"Yes, ma'am, I'll bring some."
That night, Agnes read to Desmond for the last time. It was 2 a.m. when he drifted off to sleep in the reclining chair by the window. In the morning, Agnes made him promise never to return, that it was too dangerous, and that she would only grow sicker.
"Those are my wishes, Desmond. Will you respect them?"
"Yes, ma'am."
He pedaled his bike slower on the return, the wind no longer in his sails. Why did everyone he cared about die? And the people he hated, meaning his uncle, live? Life was unfair. The world was cruel. It was midday when Desmond got home. His mouth went dry when he saw his uncle drinking on the porch.
Pretty bike, Des. Where'd you get it?
Desmond tried to swallow, but it felt like he had a mouthful of sawdust. Found it, he said with a cough.
So you stole?
No, I found it.
If you found it, then it belongs to someone. Someone you stole it from. Put it on the back of the truck. I'll take it to town and return it to its rightful owner tomorrow.
I own it, Desmond said, anger overtaking his fear. I bought it.
Bought it?
His uncle said, acting impressed.
With what money?
He spat. Desmond looked away.
You answer me when I ask you a question, boy. What money?
The money I saved.
Saved?
His uncle was mad now.
Now you bought it with money you stole. From me. I gave you that money to put food in your ungrateful little mouth. You were supposed to give me back whatever was left. You kept it for yourself and bought a little play toy.
Desmond grew quiet, let his uncle go on about how soft and useless he was. The tirade lasted nearly 2 weeks, until his uncle was set to go back to work. Instead of placing some money on the counter, he told Desmond to pack a bag.
Time to show you the real world.
The real world Orville Hughes intended to show him was a camp outside a rig just north of the Oklahoma-Texas border. He put Desmond to work, cleaning outhouses, washing clothes, peeling potatoes, and doing anything the roughnecks didn't want to do. It was hard work, but it wasn't dangerous work. His uncle said he was too weak to be a real roughneck. He'd probably always be too soft, the man told him. The workers were shaped like barrels, with muscular arms that hung at an angle, never straight down. They reminded him of the robot in Lost in Space, a program Desmond watched when his uncle was away. But unlike the robot, these men were constantly covered with oil. Their every other word was an obscenity. The stories about prostitutes and their lewd jokes never ended. They worked 12 hours on, 12 hours off, constantly drank coffee when they were awake, and never smoked near the rigs. There was a small TV with bunny ears covered in foil, and they fought about it after every shift. Baseball was usually on, and there was always a card game in one of the tents. Exactly one man out of the entire group read in his off hours. Desmond befriended him, and he was nice enough to pass Desmond the book he'd been reading, which he highly recommended. Try as he might, Desmond couldn't get into the novel, which was about people hunting for a Russian submarine. Strangely, spending time at the rigs actually helped his relationship with his uncle, such as it was. The man paid him less attention, even gave him some of the money he earned, and allowed him to keep the bike. Desmond had little desire to venture out, however. He was dead tired when they returned home from the camp. Before they were to leave again, he did ride to the library. It had reopened, and a younger woman sat behind the desk, reading a textbook, scribbling notes. Desmond avoided her. He checked out 5 books, which he read during the next tour. A few days after they returned home again, a man wearing a clip-on tie and a short-sleeved button-up shirt drove out to the house, a wake of dust rising behind his Cutlass sedan. "Mr. Hughes?" he called from the porch. Desmond watched as his uncle walked out, half-drunk, and argued with the man. The visitor put up much more fight than Desmond had expected. Finally, he shook his head, walked down the steps, and turned one last time. "If that boy of yours isn't in school next month, you won't be seeing me again. Social services will come next, then the sheriff. Good day, Mr. Hughes." Desmond found first grade quite a bit less interesting than the rigs. He could already read, thanks to Agnes, and his math was far ahead, thanks to the grocery store owner who had prevented him from starving to death. He also found it impossible to connect with the other kids. To him, they seemed just like that. Kids. Babies, almost. They enjoyed playtime, talked about childish things. He felt out of place, like he was several grades behind where he should be. The teacher noticed, tried to give him more advanced work, but she had her hands full. So Desmond was largely left alone, He sat in the corner and read while the class rotated stations around him. The principal agreed to advance him to the second grade, but he felt disengaged there, too. Summer came, and he again joined his uncle on the rigs. The work got harder with every tour. That became the routine of his life. The rigs each summer, school during the year, his uncle home only half the time. He didn't know if it was because of his parents' death or Agnes's passing, or because of the way his uncle had raised him, but he found it nearly impossible to get close to anyone. There was a wall inside of him, and the few times he brought friends over to his house, his uncle embarrassed him by berating him in front of them, so Desmond quickly learned not to invite anyone over. His uncle never gave him permission to stay over at anyone else's house either. Desmond was not stupid enough to disobey him. When Desmond brought home the sign-up form for Little League, his uncle burned it. It was a waste of time and his money, he said. Orville also refused to give consent to allow Desmond to join any of the clubs at school, Boy Scouts, or any extracurricular activities of any kind. Desmond felt completely isolated. He had no connection with anyone or anything. He was happiest when he was reading, but by the time he was 8, he had read about everything that interested him at the local library. The girl behind the desk noticed him wandering the stacks aimlessly. Her name was Julie. She was in her early 20s, and she seemed to have a new hairstyle each time Desmond saw her. It was in a bun on top of her head that day. "If we don't have it, we can get it," she said. "From where?" "Another library." She pulled the keyboard away from the computer. "We can request any book in the Pioneer Library system, they'll transfer it to us. What are you looking for?" Desmond didn't know what he was looking for. He had no idea what was out there.
"I'm not sure."
"Well, what sort of books do you like to read?" Julie asked. The last book Desmond had really enjoyed was a novel by Carl Sagan titled Contact. At the end, he had read that Sagan had a program on PBS. Desmond had wanted to watch it, but he knew Orville wouldn't allow it. He was far more interested in John Wayne than alien life and mankind's place in the universe. Desmond, however, was fascinated by the prospect of life beyond Earth and other worlds. He thought anywhere had to be better than here. At the moment, books were his only escape. "I can also search by author. Carl Sagan," he said instantly. A whole new world opened up to Desmond after that. He read science books, history books, biographies. He was fascinated with how the world got to be how it was, and with the people who made it that way. To some degree, he was trying to learn why the world was so cruel and unfair. A year later, Julie began bringing him books that weren't in the library system. She was a student at the University of Oklahoma, and their library was much more extensive. Desmond protected the tomes like treasures. His life at home continued in the usual way. In the summers, he joined Orville on the rigs. He learned that his uncle had been taking contracts closer to Slaughterville for the past few years, safer jobs at sites close enough that he could get back home quickly if Desmond were hurt or got in any trouble. Before Desmond had come to live with him, Orville had worked on rigs farther away, some offshore. The pay was better there. Conditions were often worse and more dangerous. With each passing year, Desmond was given more responsibility, put more in harm's way. He broke his right arm outside Abilene when he was 11, his leg near Galveston the following year. In May of 95, at a rig outside Nacogdoches, a roughneck who was high on cocaine dropped a swivel on Desmond's foot, crushing it. Orville beat the man to within an inch of his life. They never saw him again, on any job anywhere. When Desmond got out of the hospital, his uncle welcomed him home with a pint of cheap whiskey. It was the only thing he had for the pain, and Desmond drank it down. It was disgusting at first, but no worse than the throbbing in his foot. It got easier to drink after a while. To his surprise, his uncle didn't desert him. He brought food to his room and took him to his follow-up appointments. Their relationship changed even more after that. At 13, Desmond started high school. Thanks to his time on the rigs, he was big and broad-shouldered, with arms like a thoroughbred's legs. He was still a loner at school. He didn't fit in with any of the groups, and he had stopped trying years ago. He was stronger than the farm boys and varsity football players, and smarter than the kids who lived in town, whose parents owned the shops and had gone to college. Thanks to the library system, He knew more about history than most of his teachers, and there was a lot of math on the rigs. It wasn't calculus, but he picked that up quickly. He could attend half the year and pass all the tests. School became like visiting a prison camp on a foreign planet. People gossiped constantly. Football dominated everything. Everyone was always looking forward to the big game. Desmond only looked forward to his next book arriving, and his and Orville's next job. The locations fascinated him. Louisiana and South Texas were colorful worlds all to themselves. He cut school more and more. When the teachers began complaining, Orville visited the principal and explained that he needed his nephew's help on the rigs and that the boy would pass all his tests. An agreement was made, and from then on, Desmond attended only enough to pass a few standard tests that would appease the school board if anyone came looking. Desmond and Orville's relationship wasn't like father and son. They weren't exactly friends. They were more like drifters in the old westerns Orville watched, bound together by some shared need, on a quest, in search of something or someone, though whom or what they were searching for was never clear. They went from town to town, each town like an episode in the show, a new bad guy to best or a mystery to solve. The mystery was always how long it would take to drill the oil well, whether they'd hit oil, and whether they'd survive the days after the tour, what Orville called blowing off steam. For Orville, that usually entailed holing up in the nearest town for a week, drinking himself to sleep at the local bar, gambling, and running women. He fought a lot, too. After a certain point, he would fight the first guy who said a crossword to him. Military veterans were the only ones he wouldn't take a swing at, and their wives were the only ones he wouldn't take home. He didn't like other men doing it either. That was always cause for a fight. Fights that inevitably drew Desmond in, no matter how hard he tried to stay out of them. Eventually, he fell in beside his uncle the moment they started. The fights ended faster that way. Desmond got pretty good at sizing a man up. Knew who would be trouble, who would run, and when they should run. He developed a sort of sixth sense about whether he needed the beer bottle or the pool cue he was holding, or if his fists would do. He didn't like fighting with a knife, but he learned to take them from others. They had a few run-ins with the law, but Orville always had a good story and a few $100 for the bar owner to cover the damage. Desmond nearly always had a bruised rib, a smashed finger, a broken knuckle, a black eye, or a healing cut. Pain became commonplace to him, and so did their weird life, living by Orville's twisted code. In the hotels, they drank and listened to songs by Robert Earl Keen, The Highwaymen, Jerry Jeff Walker, and Johnny Cash until dawn. They sobered up a few days before their next job and didn't take a drink while they were working. It was too dangerous. That was part of the code, too. Desmond finally understood why his uncle had hated him so much when he'd first arrived. This was the life that Desmond had kept the man from, and Orville was finally getting back to it. That made him happy, and Desmond got some relief at home. They even went hunting together every now and then. The weeks he worked became almost therapeutic. When they were on the rigs, it was almost nonstop action, some of it dangerous. It was hard work, the kind that kept you from thinking too much. When he was working, he didn't think about his family, or Charlotte, or Agnes, or anything else. When he was off work, the whiskey and beer made the thoughts go away. It was the only thing that worked, except for books. That became his life. The rigs, drinking, and reading. His graduation in the spring of 1995 was a non-event for him. His life changed very little, except now he no longer had to take the tests. Other kids were going off to college or to Oklahoma City to get a job, but they started working full-time with their family. Desmond wanted desperately to escape, to start fresh somewhere. But he needed money to do that, so he began saving every penny he could. By January of 1996, the dented coffee can he kept in his mattress held $2,685. It was the sum total of every dollar to his name, and he was about to spend it on a device he hoped would change his life and allow him to leave Oklahoma and the rigs behind for good. Chapter 48. There were always two people outside Desmond's cell. One working the laptop with the slideshow, asking questions, another typing and filming him. He had concluded that enlisting the help of one of the interrogators was his only chance of escape. The cell was well designed and constructed. Brute force wouldn't free him. His first step was developing a profile of the captor he would turn. He had set about searching for any weaknesses or strongly held beliefs he could exploit. But thus far, his attempts to extract such information had fallen on deaf ears. He sensed Connor's hand in prohibiting the interrogators from speaking with them. None of them ever answered his personal questions. In fact, they became nervous when he addressed them personally, more nervous than they already were. And with each failed attempt, he felt his chances of escape slipping away. He had taken note of several terms that had struck him as vaguely familiar. "Do you remember the Zeno Society?" they had asked. "No. The Order of Sicium?" He lied again. He did know the term, but he didn't know how or what it meant. Meals were delivered periodically, and Desmond ate them with little concern. If his captors wanted to drug him, they could use the gas and then administer anything they wanted, and he needed to eat. He fell into a pattern. Exercise, eat, answer questions, sleep, repeat. He lost all concept of time. At some point, they began playing music, apparently hoping that would spur a memory. Desmond recognized the songs. American Remains, Highwayman, Silver Stallion, Desperados Waiting for a Train, The Road Goes On Forever, Angels Love Bad Men, and playing currently, The Last Cowboy Song. The songs were performed by a band called The Highwaymen, a quartet consisting of Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, and Kris Kristofferson. Desmond could see their faces on the cover of an old cassette tape, one that he had played many times. The songs reminded him of Orville, but he would never tell Connor that. He knew one thing for certain. Connor had started the outbreak. And if he was capable of that, he was capable of anything. If Connor needed something, Desmond would deny him. He would resist until the very end. The ship's server room was deep below decks, and the command center was adjacent. Four guards sat at a folding table playing cards just outside the main door. They rose as Connor approached and opened the hatch for him. Connor had never been in the server command center. It was impressive. Flat panel screens ran from the long desk to the ceiling. Charts and graphs he didn't recognize updated in real time. A few showed temperature readings. Progress bars crept toward 100%. On one screen, a TV show played Battlestar Galactica. The high-tech command center certainly reminded him of a spaceship, although one flown by slobs. Crunched cans of Red Bull and Mountain Dew littered the floor. Empty wrappers from microwavable snacks curled up and stuck together like ticker tape after a parade. Piles of cracker crumbs ringed the keyboards. Four faces turned in unison to stare at Connor. A skinny Asian woman with dark, greasy hair hanging past her shoulders, two overweight white guys who could have been twins, and an Indian man, a little older and much skinnier. The Indian man stood, a puzzled look on his face. "Sir?"
"I need a programmer."
"Ah," he hesitated, then pointed at a hatch at the back of the room.
"They're in there, sir."
"You're not programmers?"
"No, sir. Sys and network admins."
Connor surveyed the pigsty again. "This pack of slobs is keeping all our information organized?" He shook his head.
"Right. Carry on."
"Sir, you might want to knock."
Connor wondered what that meant. But he took their advice, rapping loudly at the hatch three times. No response. He glanced back at the Indian sysadmin, who merely shrugged as if saying, "I guess you've got to go in." Connor opened the hatch and peered inside. The cramped space made the server monitoring room look like a biocontainment clean room. Papers, wrappers, cans, and porno magazines covered the floor. Three guys in their 20s sat hunched over their laptops, headphones on, typing furiously, lines of white text on black screens in front of him. Every few seconds, one of them would curse and lean back or throw his hands up. It was like a weird human whack-a-mole exhibit.
"Hey!"
Connor shouted. Headphones came off. Annoyed faces turned to him. The closest programmer, a kid with dark hair and an Eastern European accent, said,
"What the hell, dude?
I need you to hack something for me."
"Can't. Working on CDC."
"Forget the CDC. I'll take care of it. This is a priority."
Another programmer spoke.
"Look, Talk to the bridge man. They call the shots and shut the door.
Listen to me, man. I give the bridge their orders. I call the shots. Don't make me prove it.
All three paused, eyes wide.
Oh,
the Eastern European guy said.
Okay. What are we hacking?
Someone's brain.
In the situation room outside the ship's bridge, an analyst handed Connor a report. It was still warm from the printer. The infection is at the tipping point.
Good,
Connor said, scanning the figures.
There's something else. AlphaSight reports that southern Somalia is crawling with drone flyovers. They're concerned the U.S. will find the farm soon.
Fine. Transfer Shaw and the other woman here tonight.
We've suggested that. They want more money.
Connor rolled his eyes. Fine. Pay him. It didn't matter. Money would be irrelevant in a matter of days. Chapter 49 Peyton's most recent escape attempt had been her best, but it also resulted in her jailers being more cautious with her. The black-clad soldier now used a wooden stick to push the styrofoam tray across the ground, past the bars and into her cell. A car battery sat just out of reach. Its cables ran to the closest metal bar, which buzzed with electricity. She was starving. She wanted to resist eating, but she couldn't hold out any longer. She crawled across the ground and began eating. A few minutes later, Peyton slumped forward, out cold. The soldier disconnected the car battery, opened the cell, and hoisted the skinny woman up. She was a lot fiercer than she looked. They were glad to be getting rid of her. Chapter 50 After the call with Elliot, Millen had presented his offer to the three villagers. Halima translated and talked mostly with the older woman, Damiria. They occasionally conversed with the 6-year-old boy, Tian, as well. Millen tried to imagine what the request was like for them. They had seen their family and friends die in a matter of days and were left all alone. Now they were being asked to travel to a foreign land, where they'd be subjects in medical experiments, guinea pigs to find a cure. It must be terrifying, he thought. Halima turned to Millen. You're sure you'll find a cure?
No, I'm not sure, but there's a chance. I can't promise you anything, but you three may be the key to saving a lot of people's lives.
We will be free to come back here. You'll return us when you are done.
You have my word.
We will come with you, Doctor. Call me Millen.
It was midday when Millen and the villagers arrived in Mandera. The Japanese SUV creaked on the red, dusty road, and the four of them stared at the deserted town in silence. Mandera was a chilling shell of the place Millen had seen just days before. When the team had first arrived, kids had interrupted their soccer games as the convoy passed, or rushed to the streets to get a glimpse of the visitors. Villagers carting produce and herding livestock had clogged the thoroughfare. Now there was not a soul in sight. The buildings, both new and ramshackle, lay empty. To Millen, it felt like a ghost town from America's West, an African version of Dodge City, the boom town gone bust. But a different kind of boom had gone off in Mandera, a biological bomb, perhaps more deadly than any the world had ever witnessed before. Millen expected the cities, and possibly the region's, last survivors to be concentrated at the hospital. But he found the tent complex empty and disheveled. Someone had raided everything of use. The food and every last medical supply box was gone. Some water remained, likely because it was too heavy to carry.
We'll run out of food before the transport gets here,
Millen said.
The soldiers only left me a little.
We'll search the town,
Halima said. We've become good at scavenging.
Millen got the PPE out of the back of the truck and began donning it. Halima pointed at the hospital.
You're going in there?
Yeah, it's my job.
The halls of the hospital were lined with empty buckets, bottles, and boxes that had once held medical supplies. The debris was stacked in tumbling heaps, with only a narrow walkway between them, like a mountain pass had been carved in the piles of used medical waste. Millen stepped carefully through the halls, mindful not to snag the suit or step on a needle. A mistake could be deadly. In the large open room where Hannah had taken the samples, He found rows of dead bodies. Some held wooden crosses at their chests, their eyes closed. Others stared upward, glassy-eyed, at ceiling fans that sat idle. At the back of the room, body bags were stacked against the wall. A black plastic staircase of human death that led nowhere. Flies swarmed. There were no unopened or unused medical supplies. No uneaten MREs. The room told the story of a medical mission slowly losing its battle against disease. They'd bagged and burned the bodies for as long as they could. Then it focused on the ones they hoped would survive, and then they had pulled out. Millen was certain he would find no survivors here, or food. He wandered the halls after that, peering into the patient rooms, being thorough, looking for any clues or observations he could take back to Atlanta. He found only dead bodies, all with the same hemorrhaging, jaundiced eyes, and signs of severe dehydration. Suddenly he heard a rustling. Just down the hall from him, boxes fell to the floor. He raced toward the noise, moving as fast as he could in the bulky suit. At an open doorway, he peered in. Empty. Something darted from beneath the rolling cart. It dashed toward him, between his legs, and out into the hall. Millen stepped back and turned quickly. A bat-eared fox. The sight of the animal filled him with excitement. He'd read about them before the deployment, but had never seen one. He would have loved to have seen it up close. The small fox fed mostly on termites and other insects, spiders, ants, and millipedes in particular, but also occasionally ate fungi or small animals. They hunted not by sight or smell, but sound, their large ears helping them locate even the smallest insects on the sprawling savannas of Africa. They were mostly monogamous, and the male, not the female, took the lead with caring for their young. Another bat-eared fox emerged from the room, followed by another. That made sense. They were highly social animals that typically hunted in packs. Behind him, Millen heard a door creak open. To his shock, an African man stood there leaning against the doorframe. He was weak, barely alive. But for the first time since Millen had entered the hospital, a living set of human eyes stared back at him. The survivor tried to take a step, but his legs were unsteady. Millen was at his side in seconds, offering his hand to steady the man. "I'm Millen Thomas, with the CDC." The middle-aged African surveyed Millen's face through the suit's helmet.
"Pleased to meet you. I'm Elim Kibbet."
Millen knew the name. "You're the physician in charge here." Elim smiled weakly.
"Was the physician in charge here. I'm just a patient now. I think you might be the last one." "I was afraid of that."
"Let's get you back to bed," Millen said.
"No, thank you, but I need to walk. My fever broke this morning, and I've been in that room too long. In bed too long. I need to use